This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Currie College, a private liberal arts school in Milton, Massachusetts, will continue the option of remote classes for the rest of the week after some disturbing news.
Another symbol of hate has been discovered on the Currie College campus. A swastika was found drawn inside a dorm yesterday morning. It's the latest in a string of anti-Semitic and racist messages found on campus recently.
That WBZ-TV report from just this morning, and according to police, they've been finding those swastikas for weeks, totaling more than 20. Now, the timing of this latest finding is particularly painful because the school was remote yesterday due to previous threats and displays of racism and anti-Semitism. One had mentioned yesterday's date specifically. Here is Currie College's president, Kenneth Quigley Jr., in a video released by the university.
The person or persons responsible for this must be identified, removed from our campus, and brought to justice.
Now, we reached out to Currie College to join us on the show. They were not available, but just shortly before showtime, they gave us a statement which says, in part, we are determined to keep our campus a safe, welcoming, and diverse place of learning. We will continue to diligently address these matters while also offering support and care to our community and, importantly, to any and all individuals directly affected. But Currie College isn't the first school to see this happen. Mount Holyoke College saw an incident of anti-Semitic graffiti in December. Marblehead Village School repeated incidents the same month. And we have covered a number of other similar stories here on WBUR over the past year. So we want to talk about that a bit. Joining us, State Senator Barry Feingold. Last year, he spoke with the Duxbury High School football team after anti-Semitism there, and Sarah Granoff, a junior at Simmons College and vice president of Simmons University's Hillel, a Jewish student organization. Senator, Sarah, welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Hi.
It's great to have
you. Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. And Sarah, I'm going to start with you, and I am going to ask you, first and foremost, do you feel safe?
That's a complicated question in a lot of ways. I feel physically safe on my campus. I feel part of the Simmons community, but in a lot of ways, I feel like I can't necessarily share all of my perspectives in full because I am worried about my peers and their strong opinions.
I'm sorry about that, Sarah. When you went to the university, did you expect that you might feel you had to hide part of who you are? Is this surprising to you?
I think it wasn't something I necessarily considered ahead of time. I don't think I anticipated, the college, so strong, college students having such strong, political ideals and activism being such an important part of so many of my peers' personal and political lives. I don't think I had anticipated that, as a high school student looking into colleges.
I'll come back to you in a minute, Sarah. Senator Feingold, I want to turn to you. As these, as the story about Currie College has unfolded over the last week, and again, I want to note they are not alone. This is a narrative we are having in the greater Boston region. But with this latest, what have you found yourself thinking?
Well, I think it once again comes down to a lack of education, understanding, and empathy. Half of Americans under the age of 40 can't even name one ghetto or concentration camp from World War II, and 35% of Massachusetts residents under 40 are unsure about what Auschwitz is. So I do believe that a lot of the time when people are putting up swastikas, they truly don't understand how hurtful and harmful that symbol really is. And I think one of the things that I'm most proud of that came out of Duxbury, and hopefully some good stuff will come out of the incident at Currie College as well, is we were able to pass genocide legislation that Governor Baker did sign. So I am hopeful that more and more young people will understand the implications of what Auschwitz and things like in a symbol like a swastika really means.
There is so much that I want to talk about with the two of you in what you just said, Senator Feingold. Sarah, I'll turn back to you for a second. The senator just said a lot of this is education. You listed a lot of what young people don't know. In your schooling education, Have you learned any of that? Have you been taught that in school?
I have learned about the Holocaust from a very young age, but I think that's unique to, you know, growing up Jewish. I learned about the Holocaust as early as I can remember, but I know my non-Jewish peers, you know, maybe didn't learn about the Holocaust until, you know, middle school or high school, social studies or history.
So you learned about it at home and in your faith community, in your family, Sarah?
Yes, absolutely.
So, Senator Feingold, it makes me, again, so many questions I want to ask you. Picking up on that one, it makes me wonder if there's also community dialogue we need to be in. I mean, are we just talking to each other enough in our neighborhoods and our communities about our lived experiences? Are there opportunities there that we could actually structure and grow outside of the school system to educate ourselves and each other more,
I mean,
too?
I think that's it's a great idea, a lot more difficult to pull off than having mandatory education in our public schools. I do think there will be a shift of awareness when a requirement of graduating high school is to understand about genocide. And it's just not about the Jewish genocide. It deals with what happened in the former Yugoslavia. It has to deal with what's happened in Rwanda, what's going on in China now. And I think once people understand the seriousness of it, there's going to be more empathy. And I think after that, there'll be more consideration not to put up things like swastikas and say things like Auschwitz and other things that are really hurtful to those of us in the Jewish community.
To the both of you, when I was on faculty at Boston College, we were having conversations about a number of times when racist graffiti was scrawled on dorm room walls, bulletin boards, that kind of thing. One of the things that we heard from students was, stop calling these incidents. Incidents mean it's a one-time thing. This is a pattern, and these are revelations. These are moments in those patterns. Sarah, as a student looking across what's happening in our high schools, our colleges, do these feel like incidents to you, or do they feel like moments in a pattern, moments in a larger story?
They definitely feel like parts of a larger pattern. You know, in reflecting on what happened at Curry College, I always sort of find myself not really surprised, which I think indicates that, yes, these things are part of a pattern, that they've sort of become so normal that it's not surprising anymore. I don't think they're incidents. They are part of a pattern.
Senator, do you agree?
Well, I think, unfortunately, this stuff is going to continue. But I really reflect on what Elie Wiesel really said to all of us, and that you know, we don't tell the story to try to make people weep. It's too easy for all of us to play the victim. What we really want to happen is we want the world to be a better place. And we want anti-Semitism to go down, because it is not a better world when there is anti-Semitism. So I wish I could tell you that I'm bullish that there's going to be less incidents. But I think for those of us in the Jewish community and other communities that have dealt with racism, what we really want is we want a better community. And I think the more we talk about and educate people about what we have gone through, and we talk about inclusion, we talk about empathy, we talk about understanding what it's like to walk in someone else's shoes, I do think we'll have a better society. But to answer your question on point, do I think these incidents are going to go down, or do I think they are incidents or just they're one-offs? You know, there is a segment of our society that continues to, you know, act in a certain way. But I do believe that number is declining. I do believe that, you know, when I was younger, there were more incidents, but probably not reported as much because people were afraid to speak out. So I do believe things are heading in the right direction. And with what we did with the high school education, I think that the Commonwealth will be a better place.
So, State Senator, I'm going to ask you to stand by for just a second. I'm going to turn back to Sarah for a minute. Sarah, I think my last question to you, what do you need as a young person in our community right now? And what message do you have for people who are listening and want to support you?
I think something that would make me hopeful and make a lot of my Jewish peers hopeful is seeing a lot more, you know, open dialogue about how, you know, people can understand each other better. I think seeing, like the senator is talking about, seeing, you know, more education in high schools and other public schools that cover, you know, a breadth of important topics just to sort of foster more understanding. I think that's, at the end of the day, what would be a good solution is, you know, just making sure that we're fostering as much understanding between different people as much as possible.
All right, Sarah, I'm going to thank you there. Sarah Granoff, a junior at Simmons College and vice president of Simmons University Hillel, a Jewish student organization. Sarah, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So still with us, State Senator Barry Feingold. Senator Feingold, I want to pick up on the longer arc here. We talked with you here on Radio Boston after you spoke with the Duxbury High School football team last year. Of course, it came out that they were using anti-Semitic terms as play calls. You sat down with them. You'd been a football player yourself. First, I would just ask you briefly, remind us, you know, our listeners a little bit about how that conversation went.
I thought it went very well considering the circumstance. And I do believe those young people did learn. I do believe a lot of them didn't understand what it meant for the word Auschwitz. And I do believe they are better people for it. And I do believe a lesson learned. And I was very glad that they were able to continue their football season, because I do think they will be, you know, as Elie Wiesel says, they are ambassadors, that they will tell the story about how they learned, but their whole world wasn't blown up in front of them. So I still credit that as a positive outcome of something that was incredibly negative to begin with.
Have you had any follow-up interaction with the school district, the team itself, any of the young people?
No, I mean, but, you know, the funny thing is, you know, every so often you meet someone from Duxbury and they thank you for really what people call a common sense balanced approach to try to help a community deal with a very difficult and tough situation. And I think whether it's a Curry College situation or it's a Duxbury situation, you want people to learn and become better. I just get concerned these days when we just have a punishment and there's no education. And I'm hopeful that whenever this person is caught who, you know, did the swastika, that they really understand what it really meant. Because I will bet you that more than likely, they don't understand the true ramifications of how hurtful that is to people in the Jewish community. When we see statistics that, you know, 35% of Massachusetts residents under 40 are unsure what Auschwitz was, how do we even know if they understand what a swastika is? So, you know, I just feel like, once again, education, like anything else in life, and an open dialogue is the way to solve so many of our problems in society.
You know, you have a seat and a view to our Commonwealth that is different than someone who's not an elected official. After our conversation, after the break, we're going to have a conversation with a scholar on the 20-year anniversary of his book that focuses on our nation's most reviled racial slur.
Yeah.
There is a context of hate. We just saw a trial, you know, a conclusion to a trial yesterday in Georgia, the Ahmaud Arbery trial on hate crimes, come to its conclusion. It does feel to me, Senator, like we are experiencing an accelerated drumbeat of hate, where this is a piece
of it. I've dealt with it. You know, I've had the privilege of representing the city of Lawrence, and so many people have always said that, you know, the Latinx population, you know, who are lower socioeconomic, are lazy and, you know, take advantage of welfare. And if you ever spend time with me in the city of Lawrence, you see one of the most hardest working groups of people that are so dedicated to our country, dedicated to making society better. And these stereotypes are really so disingenuous and wrong. And I hate when, you know, just not using that word, but it is so frustrating to me when people use these stereotypes that are hateful, when they just classify whether it's, you know, people in brown communities. So even though I'm Jewish, I'm very sympathetic of other races and genders that have to go through what we've been through.
So I want to ask you, you've talked a lot in our conversation today about the importance of education. What steps are the legislature taking? What are you seeing in school districts here in the Commonwealth to put this into practice, to educate our young people differently?
You know, I do believe that the Duxbury incident was a major catalyst to help get Senator Roderick's legislation passed on genocide. That bill had languished in the legislature, and now every single public school student in the Commonwealth will now have an education about genocide, you know, that is, you know, involved with Rwanda, former Yugoslavia, obviously the Holocaust, the Jewish Holocaust, the Armenian Holocaust. So I do feel that we will have a better educated Commonwealth of Massachusetts because of this legislation that the legislature passed and Governor Baker signed into law.
What gives you the most hope right now?
Our young people. I have two daughters. They're 18 and 16. And the way they look at other races, other ethnicities, so much better than we did growing up, how they're so tolerant, how they view everyone as equal. So people always criticize the next generation that they're different or we did things better in our day. I'm optimistic about this next generation because I think they're very empathetic, they're understanding, and they do want a better society.
All right. That is State Senator Barry Feingold. State Senator, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for your time.
We're going to talk now about a book written 20 years ago, actually controversial when it came out. It focused on our nation's most abhorred racial slur, the word's history, the law and litigation around it, and its cultural relevance. On its 20th anniversary, Harvard law professor and author Randall Kennedy has re-released it with a new introduction that demonstrates quite painfully how relevant the material remains today, and we want to talk about that. I am not going to say the book's title, and we will get into that more in a moment. But the subtitle is The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, and the author, Randall Kennedy, joins us now on the line. Professor Kennedy, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks so much for having me on.
I'm glad to have you on, and in a second we are going to get to your book, but I know that you actually tuned in and heard most of the conversation that we just had about a series of swastikas and racial threats on the campus of Curry College, and I wanted to give you a minute to reflect on what you heard there.
Well, I heard about something that's all too prevalent in our country, and that is various sorts of racial, ethnic hatred, prejudice of a most malevolent sort. It takes the form of graffiti sometimes. Sometimes it takes the form of, you know, spoken statements. Sometimes it takes a more violent form. But it's all too prevalent in our society. I tell you, one of the things that's most striking, though, on a different sort of note, I was very impressed by Barry Feingold and also The Student. Obviously, they were very upset about what had happened, as they should be, as we all should be. But I thought they were very thoughtful and concerned and poised, and keeping things in perspective. I mean, we live in a huge country, millions and millions of millions of people, of all different sorts. Bad things are going to happen. And while we need to mobilize against prejudice, we also need to, keep it in perspective.
So that's a wonderful way to pick up on where I want to go with your book. And I'm just going to say to listeners, we're going to have a hard conversation here, and it could make some of you uncomfortable. And I just want to give you that heads up now. So I want to be vulnerable with you for a minute, Professor Kennedy. You argue in your book that there is a difference between mentioning the N-word and using it. Mentioning it means referring to it in, for example, the title of a book, which I just refuse to do. Using it brings the full weight of its history, its malignance. And I read you as arguing that we should not kowtow to pressure on the question of mentioning it. It should be mentionable in thoughtful intellectual conversation. I refuse to mention it, however, especially as a white woman. Indeed, we allow even its mention only in rare circumstances in public radio. And I found myself, in preparing to talk to you, wondering if you'd think I was a little bit of a coward or missing an important opportunity to strip the word of some of its malignant power by refusing to use it. I'm really comfortable with you giving me your answer. Are we failing here? Am I being a coward?
No, I don't think that you're being a coward. I mean, we're talking about a very volatile word. We're talking about a word that throughout much of American history, and indeed today, in many contexts, has blood dripping off of it. There is a reason why this word generates such intense emotion. And so, no, I don't think that you're being a coward. I think that you're being prudent, and I don't hold it against you. Now, you know, I have friends whom I deeply respect who very much disagree with, you know, my book and my take, because obviously I titled my book the way I titled it. I mean, you know, the full title of my book is Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. Now, you know, some people really don't like me putting that word in the title of a book. It's in a lot of libraries, it's in a lot of bookstores, and some people feel very hurt just hearing the word. I understand that. And in fact, much of the book is dedicated to describing the history that makes people so upset. That was one of the whole purposes of me. That was one of the purposes of writing the book. I think it's also important, however, for people to understand two other things. One, let's suppose that we were talking about James Baldwin right now. You know, you and me, we're talking about James Baldwin. And you quote James Baldwin. James Baldwin used the infamous N-word. Now, he used it in what he thought to be an anti-racist way. But would it be a bad thing for you to quote James Baldwin's use of that word? In my view, no. I would say, in fact, that you're not, quote, using the word in that context. You're quoting the word. You're mentioning the word. But you're not trying to demean anyone. You're not trying to hurt anyone. And I think that we need to be able to make distinctions. Secondly, we need to recognize that all terms, all symbols, all insignia can be put to different uses. So this word, the infamous N-word, can often be used as a terrible slur, as a word to diminish people, as a word to terrorize people. But can it be put to other uses? Sure it can. Again, I just mentioned James Baldwin, his anti-racist use of the word, can mention other people. I mean, Dick Gregory, his first memoir was called N-word, a memoir. And by the way, he didn't say N-word. N-word. He enunciated the word fully. And then rappers, comedians, people put this word to various uses, and I think we need to understand that. To go back to your earlier, you know, before I came on, let's take the swastika. Swastika, you know, awful, awful symbol. Steven Spielberg has done a great movie, has produced a great movie about the Holocaust and showed the horror surrounding the swastika.
You're talking about Schindler's List?
Schindler's List. Steven Spielberg also did Indiana Jones movies, right? In which he would have Nazis in the movie, and he would be making fun of them. You would see the swastika, and he would be making fun of them. And I applaud him for that.
So
I think that we should be alive to the idea that people, through their creativity, can actually use things which have been and still are usually quite ugly, but people can also put these ugly things to creative uses. And, you know, that's part of, it seems to me, being human.
So there's a lot there. And I know that one path we could go down now in this conversation is not the path I'm going to pick. It would be, now I push back on you, right? Well, maybe nobody should ever say it. Maybe the word should be on the dust pile of history. But you've acknowledged that reasonable people disagree on this. You've acknowledged that people even very close to you don't like the way you were approaching the word, that you wrote the book this way, that you leave room for other possible uses and interpretations. So I want to stipulate that. Because in this 20th anniversary of the book, what I think I may have marveled at the most, Professor Kennedy, was actually your introduction, which is 50 new pages that lays out a litany of stories from this time, from the 20 years since you wrote the book the first time, that underscore the moment that we're in. You know, just one example, we've got the 2019 Cambridge Lingen Latin School case from here in the area. And we'll come back to that one in a minute. But I wonder, on the 20th anniversary, did you imagine that you'd have 50 pages of new stories to tell about this word that you were examining when we were in a different place 2 decades ago?
No, I was not surprised. And, you know, it could have been 100 pages. The reason why is because this word and the connotations around the word are just, you know, they represent things that are pervasive in our society, that are deep in our society. And people have all sorts of different responses. So, no, I wasn't surprised. You know, 20 years ago, I ended my book by saying that this is a word that is going to be with us. That was my forecast 20 years ago. And actually, history has shown me to be correct. And I'll make another forecast now. 20 years from now, this word will continue to be an important word in American society, for good and for bad.
So let's talk for just a minute about the Cambridge Lingen Latin School case. And, you know, in broad strokes, it was one of those cases of mentioning the word in a classroom assignment. A member of the school committee made reference to the assignment, which had the word in it. The white female school committee member said it. Ultimately, after outrage, she wound up not serving on the school committee anymore. You talk about that case in your book. And I should note, you know, your book sort of has one third about the history of the and the power of the word, one third about the law, and then one third about sort of cultural implications and looking forward. Do you think anything productive came out of the Cambridge Lingen Latin School case, either for that community specifically or in terms of what we are learning about how to grapple?
It's a great negative example. I thought that what occurred was really quite sobering. I mean, here you have a person who is on the education, you know, who clearly showed she was interested in the student's education. The teacher had used the infamous N-word in his advertisement. She goes to try to help. She mentions the word. Of course, she's not trying to put anybody down. She mentions the word. And then people want to stone her.
Figuratively.
Saying that she is being, you know, racially insensitive. I thought it was outrageous.
Why? Well, I mean, I could also hear you, based on how you laid out the book, understanding why it upset people. So why the outrage?
Well, no, it seems to me I would ask anyone, why are you upset? Do you really think, in the context of the situation, do you think that this person was trying to put anybody down? It's not like this word just came out of her mouth. On a bus or in the mall without a context. She was there at a meeting that had been advertised by the teacher. The whole purpose for the meeting was to assist the students in doing research on tabooed expression. So there was a context there which should have nullified any idea, any notion that this person was trying to be racially insensitive.
So I want to stay there for a second. As I was reading the book, I was just thinking about the absolute nuclear power of this word. And how does any word get to the point where it has that kind of nuclear power to it, where it is that explosive? It's a word.
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things. Number one, there's a history to it. You know, the American language is full of derogatory words. Take a look at the chapter in H.L. Mencken's great book on the American language. It's just American language full of slurs. This one, however, is quite singular. This is the one that is the baseline for all of the others. One of the things that got me interested in writing a book was I went to a computer service and asked, give me the citations for every case in which this word appears.
You mean legal case?
Legal case, federal cases, state cases, military law cases. There were more cases involving this word than all of the other slurs combined. Mm. I mean, it was totally different. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, this word has been in the backdrop of many racial atrocities. And so there is a reason for people to approach this word with, you know, special caution. I get that. Fine. Nonetheless, that's right. It is a word, and we should know that words can be put to different uses. And we need to recognize that there's a difference between the use of a word and the mention of a word. Let me give you an example. In the 1930s, Washington, D.C., the Washington, D.C. school system had created a rule that said, we are going to toss out any publication in which this word appears. Do you know the first publication that was tossed out of the D.C. schools? The first publication that was tossed out of the D.C. schools was The Crisis, which was the publication of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People.
The NAACP.
The NAACP. The Crisis had an article attacking a politician who used this word. And they announced, they published the word, and that was the first publication thrown out. Well, see, that's the sort of thing you get when you lose perspective and when you don't make distinctions.
So, Professor, we are down to just a few seconds left. You've already predicted we're going to see this word 20 years from now. So, in a word, should we?
Yes, we should, because this is an important word in American history, and if we want to know about our history, we have to reckon with everything, the good and the bad. This is a word that has much bad, but it's also a word that has been put to other uses, including good uses.
All right, that is Randall Kennedy, Harvard Law Professor and author of N-Word: The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word. And that's my censor, not his. Professor Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Be well.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. You're hearing A Blues in Tyne by pianist, singer, and composer Alexis Lombre from her 2017 album South Side Sounds. Lombre is one of seven young women and non-binary artists who make up this year's inaugural Next Jazz Legacy Class of Awardees announced today. Next Jazz Legacy is a partnership between the Berklee College of Music's Institute for Jazz and Gender Justice and New Music USA. The three-year program aims to break open a historically male-dominated jazz scene. By providing emerging artists from underrepresented backgrounds with financial support, professional support, as well as mentorship from established working musicians in the jazz genre. Three-time Grammy Award-winning drummer and composer and founder of Berklee's Institute for Jazz and Gender Justice, Terry Lynn Carrington is the artistic director of Next Jazz Legacy. We talked with Terry Lynn Carrington late last year about the launch of the program. We wanted to revisit that conversation today with the announcement of these fellows. When we spoke, I began by playing Terry Lynn a bit of her own music when she was the house drummer for the Arsenio Hall show. It's a cover of Blackbird by the Beatles. So I wanted to play that for you because in watching the video, Terry Lynn, you are a woman in almost entirely surrounded by men. Talk about that, this place of women in jazz.
Well, that's been the case throughout my whole career. I got my union card when I was 10, I think, here in Boston. And I'm 56, so I've had 46 years of professional drumming so far. And it's always been dominated by men. And I just took that as the way it is, and I accepted it, and I thought that was normal. And about 5 years ago or so, I started really feeling like we needed to make more space, you know, not in a couple of years, not 10 years down the line, but right now. And that's when I started the Institute at Berklee. But this program is a partnership with New Music USA. And Vanessa Reed, who's the president and CEO of New Music USA, we've been concocting this for about a year and a half. And, you know, very pleased with the fact that we're able to do it through the funding of Mellon Foundation. And will affect at least 20 young women and non-binary performers within the next 3 years.
So, you know, I know a study done by NPR Music Jazz Critics poll in 2019 showed that fewer than 16% of artists on jazz records were women, for example. What will this program do for upcoming jazz artists who are women, who are non-binary, to help change the landscape of the genre?
Well, I think we'll draw more attention to the fact that young women and non-binary artists need to be mentored more and have these types of apprenticeship situations to really get their playing on the level that they want it to be. Because often what happens is women end up playing together because that's the community they're in, and they're not able to necessarily always break through with some of their male colleagues that they want to play with, or their people they look up to. So they end up playing together or becoming band leaders maybe a little too early before they're ready. Because I know that most of the people that I know that are great, they really studied under somebody. When I say study, I don't mean at a school. I mean on stage, traveling, learning on the job. And that's really the only way you can learn how to play jazz. So this program is to help these 20 women that will affect in the next 3 years, help them find apprenticeship situations.
I want to talk a little bit more about that apprenticeship. You know, I feel like in the last couple of years, especially in the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement, we've started to have a more in-depth conversation about both the experiences of women in the workplace, but also mentorship and what's been missing in bringing up the next generation. And now we're increasingly having that same conversation for members of the non-binary community, the LGBTQ community. How essential is somebody bringing you up to being able to take the next step in a career as just unbelievably competitive, I'm assuming, as jazz?
Yes, it's extremely competitive. And when young people graduate from college, if they go to college, you don't have to have graduated from college to be in this program. But when you do graduate and you go into the professional world, the competition is great. In fact, when I graduated, well, I didn't graduate from Berklee, but when I left Berklee in 1983, I think it was, 84, my mentor, Jack DeJohnette, he told me to go to New York and put myself in the environment where the competition is the greatest. And basically I was sink or swim. But he was there to, you know, to help me. But he also told me that my competition was him and everybody else that played the drums that, you know, lived in New York or that played jazz. So it is extremely competitive. And I feel like without these types of mentors and without apprenticeships, you don't really have the same chance. You know, you don't, you're not on the scene in the same way. You know, somebody has to show you the ropes. And that's how jazz has always been. And that's, you know, what the foundation of the music is passed down from one person to another.
I'm going to play you a little more of your music again. This is from your record, TLC and Friends. You were 16. Here is La Bonita. Bear with me as I connect these dots, because I'm listening to this music you as a young person playing, and I'm thinking about newly elected Boston Mayor Michelle Wu last night in her victory speech saying that her sons asked her, hey, can a boy run for mayor too? Which was a framework for them because they only knew a girl running for mayor. Would your music then have been different in any way if you'd been seeing girls all around you?
Well, I'm not sure how different it would be, but I would suspect that it would be different because I'm always compared to men. And as far as I was concerned, I had to play as good as the next guy. And that was what I tried to do. I didn't want anybody to say I played like a girl because I would have taken that not as a compliment. Now I feel like we have to embrace our differences and be open to a possible different aesthetic in the music. Based on our gender identity. And I was never open to that before. And now I am. So I try to embrace it within myself more. It worked out for me because I was a tomboy growing up and I always wanted to, you know, play with the boys and play sports, even though I wasn't very good at it. But I wanted to do the things that the boys did. And I think some young women, you know, naturally aren't that way, and nor should they have to be able to make it in jazz.
Are there women or non-binary artists who have really influenced you?
Well, I believe in mutual mentorship. So my students influence me all the time. I have so many students that I learned from. I think it helps me to remain relevant. It keeps me up to date with what's happening and keeps my ideas fresh. So I would have to say yes, you know, to that in some ways. But just as far as, you know, my main influences, there weren't very many women at all, you know, while I was developing. So, you know, unfortunately, I don't have any mentors that were female.
And that's really what this is about, right? I'm 10 years from now, I get to talk to another jazz artist who answers that question differently.
Yes, that is exactly what it's about. But it's not women mentoring women. It's everybody mentoring women. So our band leaders will be both male and female, because a big part of this program is for the people that have benefited the most from, you know, oppressive structure that we've been dealing with. I mean, I think they have a real responsibility to help change it as well.
What are you hearing from musicians in the jazz community about this program? What's the response been?
Well, we just launched a couple of days ago, so I haven't heard a whole lot.
Early days.
Yeah, but I mean, in general, all the work that I do with the Institute has been embraced by most of my male colleagues. And I mean, what I find interesting is either people are progressive or they're not. And it often doesn't boil down to their gender, because there are women that they don't want to be a part of anything that is centered around women, because, you know, we've been trained well to think that that means it's not as good, or that we're bringing attention to the fact that women, and people, you know, will say to me all the time, I'm not a woman this or a woman that, you know, I'm just, you know, just a musician. And I understand that, because that's how I felt. And that was my response as well years ago. But, you know, as I said, now I'm trying to embrace what might make me different and embrace all the sides of myself.
You mentioned founding Berklee's Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice. So let's fast forward 10 years. You're looking at jazz 10 years from now. You're thinking back on this week when you launched this program. How might music be transformed?
How might music be transformed? Well, I think the most important thing is that we're trying to transform the culture. You know, and I think the music will tell its own story. But we're trying to shift the narrative. And so far, that narrative has remained pretty heavily on men play the instruments and women sing. That's kind of an unspoken narrative that I've seen in jazz. And you always have a few women that pop up that play great, but then there are the exceptions. And we're trying to, you know, make the, you know, help the culture change to not accepting that there are a few women that are exceptions, but we want to have women that are great, women that are mediocre, you know, all throughout the entire ecosystem.
So that was Terry Lynn Carrington, three-time Grammy Award-winning drummer, Berklee Institute of Jazz and Gender Justice founder, and artistic director of the New Jazz Legacy Program. It announced its first class of awardees today. And that is our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick and Amanda Beland. We had help today from Francisca Monahan, Sarah Leeson, and Matt Ledden. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. So great to be with you today. Thanks for listening. Hope you will join us again tomorrow, because at 3 o'clock, there will be more Radio Boston.